Hello there, I'm Gary Critcher. I grew up in London, the UK. I was born in September 1958, just in time 5 years later for the Beatles to hit, so I've been a fan of theirs ever since. But what I really want to talk about is growing up in the UK with British comedy. I didn't really take much note of much comedy before I was 9 or 10. And I was thinking the other day that the earliest memory I have of any sort of comedy that made an impression was my parents, I think in the summer of 1967, gave me a small transistor radio, the size of a, in fact, it might even be slightly smaller than a mobile phone, an iPhone these days. And it just ran on one little battery, and you could literally add a carry case, and you could literally virtually strap it to your belt, even though I didn't do that at the age of 10. But I definitely remember one evening going to bed and taking the radio with me and switching it on and listening to and it would have been the BBC Light programme back then, or the Home Service, Around the Horn, an episode of Around the Horn. I can definitely remember that. I can't remember anything about the program, but I can definitely remember listening to a Around the Horn. So that was round about 67 when I was 9. So then we move on slightly. There wasn't much. I do remember Do Not Adjust Your Set, because that was on ITV, not the BBC, in London, because ITV was regional companies and they would show programmes at different times, the same programme at different times. And in London, Do Not Adjust Your Set went out at something like 5 o'clock in the afternoon. That was definitely the first time I saw people like Michael Palin, Tim Brooke Taylor, Graham Garden, I think, was in that. Obviously, David Jason. But I have no specific memories of that. I know I would have seen it. Until we get to a little bit later. Now, I do remember, and I've looked it up, I think it was one series that they made of, that the BBC made, of a Terry Scott and Hugh Lloyd series called The Gnomes of Dulwich, which apparently didn't go down very well and was, they only did 6 episodes and none of them exist. I think I've seen a couple of stills on the internet, but I definitely remember that. That was a bit weird because they had these sort of plastic masks on their faces to make them look like they had sort of gnomish features and beards. But I do remember that. That was 69, I think. And I didn't. Now, I did certainly listen to The Goodies. Sorry, watched The Goodies. Python was on at the same time, but that was, sorry, at the same time, but not at the same time, if you see what I mean. Python was more a late night program, whereas The Goodies was, it was always, they sort, didn't the Beeb try and sort of think of it as a children's program, or, you know, to be seen earlier in the evening rather than 10:30 or 10 o'clock or even later for Python. So I was definitely watching The Goodies which would have been obviously 1970 onwards. I didn't see any of the precursors to The Goodies, like Broaden Your Mind and Twice a Fortnight. I certainly never saw any of those, definitely. I've seen a few bits and pieces since. And of course, the other one I did would have watched, again, the same sort of crew would have been at last, the 1948 show, which was Tim, wasn't it? Marty, Graham Garden, Graham, the other Graham from Python. So then we're moving towards 1970, 71 with The Goodies, Dad's Army. Yes, but it really wasn't quite my thing as much as the Goodies were. Certainly, I did have a liking, because it was a little bit off the wall sometimes, was Eric Sykes' programmes. who could be slightly outlandish compared to a normal sitcom, even though it really was, when you look at it now, it was a normal sitcom. But I used to like that too. And then growing up into 73, I was definitely watching Python, because I was, 13, 14 at that point, and I definitely remember Python, which was the episode, I don't remember why I remember this, but it was one of Gilliam's, no it wasn't, it was just a still of the Matterhorn, or something like that, or Mount Everest, and I think it was Palin would just lean across the screen, and the voiceover would say, Mount Everest, the mountain with the biggest tits in the world. I don't know why I remember that. I certainly remember Palin's favourite Python sketch, which was the fish slapping dance. I definitely remember that, and that had me in howls of laughter for no good reason. As Palin has said in the past, it's just silly. You know, it doesn't matter. It means nothing. It's just a bit of fun. Go along with it. So 73, I then, on the radio. Now, I don't know how I found this, because I was still at school, obviously. I found I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue, which had all the goodies in it. And Willie Rushton and Barry Cryer. Obviously, Bill dropped out because he didn't enjoy it. It was a little too much pressure to be funny instantly sort of thing. But I did record on cassette 6 episodes of I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue from 73. And I think I found out that they might be the only recordings of that series, which I think was series 3. It was quite early. Bill was still in it at that point. And even now, I've still got them. Obviously, I've since, over the years, dubbed the cassettes onto quarter-inch tape and then onto CD, which I still have. And, you know, in the very rare occurrence now that I will play one, yes, I'm word perfect, because who wouldn't be after playing those programs so many times? At the same time, I did hear a few Hello Cheekies, which was, I didn't like as much. And then I found out, either one way or the other, I found out I'm Sorry I Read That Again, which by the time I got into it, it had finished. And Hello Cheeky, I always thought was a pale imitation of Iserta, I'm afraid. Not as good. And I listened to, I think I've got still 2 cassettes of some Iserta repeats from 1974. I think 2 of those were repeats of the 73 season, the last season, and maybe a couple of earlier episodes. And of course, they've been dubbed onto CD now as well, blah, 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 which they're all around. You know, there's nothing rare with these things. So we get into 75 and we're still doing the goodies. Python. I did go and see, and I've just remembered this, the first time I went to see Monty Python and the Holy Grail, the only place to see it was at the cinema. And I went to see it in the school summer holidays in 1975 when it came out. And it was on at, unbelievably, the Hammersmith Odeon, world famous for concerts and live shows, and what even was then. But I went to see a film there. And I think I've read that the Hammersmith Odeon, I don't know what it's called these days, the Apollo something. I'm afraid it's always going to be the Hammersmith Odeon. I've seen hundreds of concerts there since. But it was, I think it's the largest cinema in Europe. It's something like 3,500 seats. Anyway, I went there on a Wednesday afternoon to catch the matinee of the Holy Grail. And I went upstairs into the Circle, which was massive. And it's a huge place. Obviously, otherwise they wouldn't have concerts there to this day. And just before the lights, I went on my own because I was summer holidays. You know, I wanted to go and see the film. Went from Chiswick, where we lived, the bus to Hammersmith. And you get out the bus and you walk across Hammersmith Broadway. And you're there. There's the theatre there. Walked in, got a ticket, went upstairs, sat down, and I'm looking around. I probably had some popcorn or something. And there must have been, in my row of seats, let's say 200 seats, 300 in a row, from wall to wall. And you know what? There was no one else there. So I had a front row seat in the circle, and you could stand up and look down over into the stalls downstairs. And I think there was about four people. Anyway, you know, watched the film, loved it, because it's Python. And it was a bit odd, bit unusual, something different from their TV shows, because it was a continuous story rather than just bits. So that was good. So I remember seeing that. So a year later, I'm finishing exams at school at the age of 16, and that was it. I didn't go to college. Mum and Dad couldn't afford it. So, but I'd already shown interest. I was heavily into music back then, still am. And a friend of mine, a friend of the family, she worked at Television Centre, BBC, and she found a job advertised. It must have been internally, but she showed it. She brought it round. It was in Ariel, the BBC internal newspaper. And she showed it to me. She said, Gary, it's for the BBC transcription service. And I've gone, what's that? She said, well, it's to do with records. You like records, don't you? And I've gone, well, yes, but what's it about? And I have no idea. So anyway, I wrote off and got an interview. But what I did first was I did a holiday relief in doing that actual job for 2 weeks in August of 76. Now, if you're in the UK, you'll remember the summer of 1976 as the hottest summer we'd ever had, or so it felt. It might not be in the record books, but it was so hot. I remember people were bathing in the fountains in Trafalgar Square, that sort of thing, because it was so hot. Anyway, I did my first two paid weeks of work that month in transcriptions in the dispatch department, which was as low as you could get. It was basically pulling records. I'll tell you what about those in a moment. It was pulling records off a shelf, putting them in a box, packing them up, taping them up, putting an address label on them. And then every evening we would take the whole pile of boxes down to the local post office and post them. And we would be posting these boxes of records. Now, the records contained BBC recordings, sound recordings, of anything you can possibly think of. It would be classical music concerts. It would be rock music in concerts. It would be Top of the Pops. It would be drama from Radio 3. You name it, we had license to use it, including radio comedy. And on the shelves, there weren't just thousands of records. There were hundreds of thousands of records. 12-inch discs that were pressed when I first started there. They were still being pressed by EMI and Decca in London Records. After a while, we farmed it out to a company in Wales called Nimbus Records, because we only wanted, when we ordered the records, we only ordered 70, 80, or a maximum of 100 copies. That was it. And when we ran out, which we sometimes did, people bought them. And they were bought, by the way, by overseas radio stations. So you name it, every country in the world would buy BBC radio programs from us. That was the only way you could get them, including America, New Zealand, Australia, Japan, Africa, Europe, you name it. We would send them out in boxes, in cardboard boxes, believe it or not. Some of these boxes would have 100 discs in them. Some would have only four. It doesn't matter. It depends on what the people were buying. So then we would take them down to the post office every day at 4:30 and just give them to them. And the post office guy would sign them off. They would disappear into the post. And 2 weeks later, it depends on how they were ordered. If they were going by airmail or surface mail, how quickly they were delivered, or air freight, which is obviously express. And when these discs were finished, were ran out, and we didn't have any left, but we still had an order. We could still do copies. What we would do, we would get the master tape out, and an engineer upstairs would do a quarter-inch tape copy to send out instead of a disc. There was absolutely no point ordering another 70 copies because you would never sell those. You would, for a new issue, then you know, obviously people would be interested in buying those. But after a while, obviously interest slowed down. And if the discs, some discs never ran out because we didn't sell them all. And we even had on the shelves lots of records from the mid 60s that were still sitting on the shelves ready to be sold, brand new. But no one ever bought them. And after a while, we used to work weekends. We only worked Monday to Friday, but you'd go in on a Saturday, never a Sunday. And guess what we used to do? We would have a list of old discs that were sitting on shelves. We would pull them all out. And we'd have two or three old, do you remember the old tin dustbins for your rubbish in the weekly rubbish collection? We'd have about three or four of those, and we'd have two hammers. Are you ready? So these discs, no matter what they were pulled off the shelf because they were unwanted. They're obviously not going to, we still had the master tape. So if anyone did out of the blue order a copy and we didn't have a disc, we'd do them a tape. A dub. So these discs that we were pulling off the shelves that were surplus to requirements and taking up room were smashed into pieces. And then you would find out through the runoff groove on the disc which company had pressed them, because the wax was slightly different between EMI and Decca. And we would have a rubbish bin of Decca and a rubbish bin for EMI. And then once every 3 months, we would ring them and they would send a van over, the record companies, to collect this vinyl. And guess what they did with it? They melted it down and reused it because we didn't need it anymore. But obviously, we weren't stupid. If there was something that came out to be scrapped and smashed and it was interesting, like an old Top of the Pops disc from the 60s, which we did have some, which featured... back in the 60s, the BBC wasn't allowed, it was called needle time. You only had a little bit of needle time per week or per month. So the music had to be recorded by the original bands, especially at the BBC for BBC use. So these are slightly plus interviews with the groups. And these will be used by transcriptions for our weekly Top of the Pops programme, which was still being issued then with Brian Matthew introducing. But back in the 60s and into the 70s, some of the music on the discs would be radio sessions, BBC recordings that were different from the records. So that we knew that if and when a Top of the Pops disc came out to be scrapped, we would mark on the paperwork, yep, scrapped, because there was no one there checking. And we would keep them. There might only be two copies, or there might be six copies, there might be ten. So we'd go, what's on it? We'd have the cue sheets with them to tell us what the songs were on the discs. And we'd go, oh, it's got some Deep Purple or Led Zeppelin. I'll take that one home for yourself, just to listen to, you know, and keep. So we used to do that, obviously, under cover of not telling anyone. So we used to do that. At the same time, on the announcement notice boards in the corridors, in the offices, transcripts were at BBC Kensington House, which is on the opposite side of Shepherd's Bush Green, round the back. It's now the K West Hotel, and it was built in a railway siding. So the building, as you walk down it, actually bent in the middle with the curve of the old railway track, which obviously was long gone. So that's where we were, and every month there would be on the notice board for staff a list of recordings where you could just apply for tickets for free. And it was amazing. You just write off and you'd in the internal post, and you'd write to ticket unit, which was only around the corner at Shepherd's Bush, and say, can I have two tickets for whatever recording, please, on the 15th of November? And if there wasn't too much sort of, you know, demand, or you got in quickly, within, I think, maybe 2 or 3 weeks of the recording happening, you got your envelope back in the internal post with, guess what? Two tickets inside, and they were free. And it could be anything from Parkinson recordings, Old Grey Whistle Test, Top of the Pop was a little bit more difficult to get hold of, obviously, because the public were allowed into that. I mean, the public were allowed into anything, but I don't know what the percentage was for tickets that were kept back for staff as opposed to public. Either way, you didn't pay for them. No one paid for them. You just had to make yourself, get yourself down there to wherever the recording was going to be. And you got in for free and you watched the whole recording. And then during the recording itself, you were told, if it was radio or television, you would be told when it was being transmitted. So you either write it down or make a mental note that in the case of some TV programs, it would only be about 10 days before you saw it on the television. Sometimes it'd be 6 months. You know, it just depended on the scheduling and stuff. I was trying to think the other day, making a few notes for this recording. I can't remember my first comedy recording. I can remember my first recording that I went to, which wasn't comedy, it was music, in March 1977. I and one of the other guys that I worked with went to Golders Green Hippodrome, which was a BBC building, but it was a very big one, a music venue. They did, in the end, use it for talk shows and stuff later. And this was one of the, if you remember, a series called Sight and Sound in Concert, which was a revolutionary thing back then, because what they used to do was we used to film it for television, like a normal concert, but it was also being recorded by Radio 1 in stereo, and it would go out at 7 o'clock on a Saturday night. Those episodes would go out simultaneously on BBC Two and Radio One. So the idea was that if you had a good stereo and you had it near your TV, you turn the TV sound off and listen to the concert and watched it, but with stereo sound. So the first one I ever went to, as I say, this is the first recording I ever went to, was a group called Pace Ashton Lord, which was two guys from my favourite band of Deep Purple, and Tony Ashton, who'd been in Ashton, Gardner and Dyke earlier in the decade. And that was interesting because the recording didn't go smoothly at all, because the lighting rig kept not blowing up, but stopping working. So they must have stopped three times in the middle of songs and sort of waited for the lighting guys to repair or do whatever they had to do. And I remember the second breakdown, because there was 400 of us in the audience, and you know, the floor manager's come up and said, sorry everyone, we've got a problem with the lighting, we're going to fix it. And the band just stood there, you know, on the set. So someone shouted out, drum solo, and Ian Pace gave us a completely impromptu, exclusive, unrecorded drum solo for us in front of him, which was great, because even now he's still a brilliant drummer. So that was finished, and that went out, I think maybe 10 days after the recording. That was like on a Wednesday, and it was not the next Saturday, but the Saturday after that it went out on air. And of course, by then I think I'd saved up enough money to buy myself a quarter-inch tape recorder. And I recorded that on quarter inch. Obviously, I couldn't record it on video because no one had video machines then. No ordinary household had a video machine. But I do now. So getting back to comedy, digress there, sorry. I can't think if I went to any, and I don't know why, earlier comedy recordings, but I do remember in November of 77, I went to a recording at Television Centre. That was probably the first time I went into Television Centre for a recording. I've been in there before with some friends and we've been shown around when I was still at school. But in November 77, I went to a Goodies recording, which I've always referred to as Rock Goodies, which is the punk one. And apparently it's been called Punky Business. So that's the one I went to in 77 with a Beatles connection. Jane Asher was in that episode, wasn't she? I can't remember much about that recording. But that was certainly the first one I went to. Now, for the next couple of years, I'm still at transcriptions at this point. But the next few years, I can't remember going to any. No, certainly no sort of, you know, music programs. But the next thing that rears its head was, I'm still at transcriptions, and I don't know why I hadn't done it before, but I saw the on the ticket list, radio. I'm sorry, I haven't a clue. Back in those days, I think there were only 6 episodes in the series. And believe it or not, that was recorded over 3 days only. And that was it, finished for the whole year. So I went to them, I got some tickets. And in the end, I've looked it up and I've looked up the dates, the transmission dates for, I'm sorry, I haven't a clue. I think I went to virtually every recording in the 1980s because they were free. And they were being recorded on like a Wednesday afternoon at the Paris Theatre in Lower Regent Street in the middle of London. And I used to take a day off work because there was no point doing a morning. You could have done that to save holiday, but I never bothered. So after a while, I realised that if I got there early, the Paris was a lovely old place. It's gone now. Of course, it's a bloody gymnasium now, isn't it? That's another example of the BBC selling off their assets. And of course, don't forget that the Paris Theatre has a massive history of BBC recording, going back to, I'm not sure about pre, but certainly during the war, they recorded programmes there, and it would have been things like Itmar, It's That Man Again, and coming through the 50s, certainly The Goon Show was recorded there. But the main thing I thought of when I went in there in I did go to some recordings before 1980s. I went in there in, I think it was March 78, to see a Radio 1 in concert, which you can get tickets for. Again, simple as free, everything. And it was David Coverdale's Whitesnake, another Deep Purple connection. And they were, it was 2 bands, because they'd record, because the programme on air would be half an hour per band live. But, and the 2 bands were there for that evening, and they would record maybe 40, 45 minutes. And then a couple of songs might be dropped to cut it back to half an hour each, 28 minutes each. And the other band that night were The Only Ones, if you remember them, Peter Perrett, who were okay. Whitesnake were the top bill, probably only because of Coverdale, because they hadn't had many records out by that point. So, yes, I went to that one. But getting back to the history of the Paris, the stage, when I walked in, and by the way, obviously, one of the things on the back of all BBC tickets is no cameras. What did I do? I took my camera, 35mm camera. So I get in, and it's in a bag, no problem, got it in through security. And we're sitting there, and there's 2 security guards on either side of the stage, just standing there, having a chat. There's obviously not going to be a riot. So The Only Ones come on and do their stuff. Another Girl, Another Planet, that sort of stuff. And 15, 20 minutes break. Whitesnake come on, and I pull the camera out, and I see it. I see one of the security guards look at me. Now, don't forget, I'm a member of BBC staff at this point, too. So, and the ticket specifically says no cameras, even though it's a radio recording. So I remember I had a new film in it, and I fired off one shot through the seats, of which I got mainly the ceiling when I got it back. And that was it. I put it back in the bag, and that was it, because in theory, I could have lost my job. In theory. So anyway, so that was 70. That was March 78. Whitesnake. So fast forward. That was what I was going to say about the Paris itself. When you walk in, the front row of the seats are only 5 yards, 10 feet from the stage. And there's nothing. It's not like a normal... It used to be a cinema. It used to be called the Paris Cinema. I don't know when they stopped showing films. And the stage itself that the band or the performers are sitting and standing on was 5 inches high. It's like a step. And that was it. There was nothing else separating us, the audience, from them, the band. So talk about intimate. But no... lighting at all, just house lights, no lighting whatsoever, no changing colors, nothing. So it's just white light, white light, white heat, you could say. So jumping forward to, I'm sorry, I haven't a clue. That would have been recorded on like a Wednesday afternoon, around about 2 o'clock onwards. And they would record two episodes in one session with about a 20, 15 minute break in between the two. Now, I realised that if I got up there early, because you didn't have seats, you just got in and sat down where you wanted. So there was no allocated seat numbers or anything. If you got there early and you wanted something to eat and drink, round the corner was a pub called The Captain's Cabin. And I used to go around there for, how old was I then? 18? For a lemonade and a sandwich. But I think about the second time I walked in, guess who was there? The whole cast, sitting in a corner, having a couple of beers before they went round the back to go into the recording. I never spoke to any of them, but they were all there, all of them. Humph, you name it. So that was good fun. And imagine doing a whole series of, I'm sorry I haven't a clue, in 3 days. They wouldn't do it sort of Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. They would do it on a Wednesday, 3 weeks running, if you see what I mean. So it wasn't, you know, an intense finished in a week job, but nearly sort of thing. So that was that. So I went to all of those. And of course, then in the meantime, I went to lots of other studio TV recordings as well as radio. I've got a little list here. Going back to pre-80s, I went to, with a friend who I'm still in contact with now, 3 episodes of 40 Towers in the second series. The psychiatrists, not Mrs. Richards, I can't remember the other ones, but they were good. So that was 79. Radio-wise, there wasn't a lot, actually, because I always thought, I'm sorry, I haven't a clue, was the best you could get for an audience show. But jumping across to television, things like in the 80s, as I say, 40 Towers, Parkinson, went to a few of those, which are really good because they were recorded on a Saturday evening, normally finished round about 9:30 in the evening. Parkinson, you never knew who the guests were going to be until you got in and sat down in the studio. So you couldn't get up and walk away if they told you before. otherwise, they'd have no one there if there's not a very good guest. Parkinson was usually recorded in one go, straight through without a break, as you saw on the TV. So it would be finished 10 o'clock at the absolute latest, because it was on air after, if you remember, it was on air after Match of the Day at 11 o'clock. So you had to turn it round quick. I can't remember who I saw on Parkinson, but that was always good. But comedy-wise, which is what we're talking about, as I say, 40 Towers, Blackadder, Ever Decreasing Circles. I went to a lot of Spike Milligan recordings. I think it was Q6, certainly Q7 and Q8. The Young Ones, I went to 3 or 4 of those, if not more, actually. And what a difference between... people like Spike Milligan, who was absolutely bonkers. He would do a sketch, they'd record it, and either at the end of the evening, they would say, oh, we really got to do that one again, Spike. Or they would say straight away, someone would fluff a line and they'd stop straight away. And okay, we go again. And the first three lines of the sketch would be the same as the previous take. And then Spike would just go off. And he's now saying things that were never said, were not in the script, not been rehearsed. And these poor people in the cast would have to keep up with him. John Bluthal would have to keep up with him and just go with it. That's why some of the laughter you might hear on some of the sketches these days, it's because we'd maybe seen that recording, that sketch twice already, and neither of them, and this was the third version, and none of them were the same. So, and Spike, in between takes, where they were setting up the next scene, would be on the microphone playing around with the audience. Compare that to someone like Rowan Atkinson during the Blackadder. He's not, I mean, I'm not having a go at him at all. He's not a comedian. He's a comic actor, and a very good one. But he, in between scenes on the Blackadder, he would never, hardly ever talk to the audience for a start, let alone have a laugh and a joke like Spike would. Cleese on Fawlty Towers, yes, he would muck about. If you've got the various Fawlty Towers DVD sets, there's outtakes on some of them, and you can see Cleese playing around in between scenes or when people fluff a line. And the one I do remember I was there was the psychiatrist, where Sybil, right, they're having an argument. Basil and Sybil are having an argument, and Sybil runs away from Basil and runs back to their bedroom and slams the door on him. And in the outtake, the whole wall just wobbles all over the place because it's made of wood. You know, it's as flimsy. And Cleese just sort of puts his hand to the wall to say, oh, what's going on here? And taps it to make sure it's strong enough. That sort of stuff was good. That was really good fun. But, of course, then you get the correct take two where it didn't. I remember for that, they actually had two scenery hands holding the wall out of shot so that when she slammed the door, it didn't roll backwards and forwards. So, Cleese was good because he's good in front of an audience. Rowan Atkinson, not so much. He would certainly say thank you, hope you enjoyed it at the end of the evening. But other than that, during the whole recording, he wouldn't get involved with the audience whatsoever. You'd have a warm-up guy for all these shows, not radio, but television, who would be telling jokes and, you know, interacting with the audience to keep you warmed up and enjoying yourselves while cameras were being repositioned, etc., etc. And so some of the cast would have a chat and you'd say, you know, oh, let's have a word with Tim. And Tim Brooke Taylor would come over and, you know, do a little 5-minute chat, or maybe even taking the question from the audience and stuff like that, which is good. So all through now, at the same time, when I worked eventually at Transcriptions, I managed to sort of go higher up the ladder. And in the end, I was in charge of the tape library at Kensington House. Now, don't forget that Transcriptions would actually originate their own programs, let alone use radio programs from Radio 1234, and even the very, very odd regional program we'd use too, or use snippets from them. I was in charge of the library, which was huge because it went back. I'm trying to think when it went back to. It was certainly late 50s, quarter inch tapes. And again, like we used to do with when we scrapped the records in dispatch, we would have to, once every 3 months, 4 months, I would have to go through all the shelves. Now, if you've got a tape with a green M sticker on it, you kept that because that was a master. That was an edited master, and you never want to throw that away. But you'd have a non-master of the same program, which is like the recording before Transcription edited it. We would have to edit a half-hour program down to 27 minutes, 28 minutes, 27 and a half minutes, because the radio stations abroad that we sold the discs to were commercial stations. So they needed to have time in the hour to play adverts. So instead of a play being 30 minutes, 31 minutes, on Radio 3 or Radio 4 in the UK, we would have to cut it down to 28 minutes just so they could play some adverts when it finished before the next programme started, whatever that was. So we would have a non-master, which was the programme before the edit. So sometimes we would have a non-master and we would dub it. So you'd have two non-masters. So the first non-master would be cut physically, shortened. So the duration would be shortened and that would become the master tape. Okay. And the bits we cut out were normally literally chucked in the bin. But don't forget, no matter, the domestic stations, Radio 3, Radio 4, whoever, have got their own master tape. So we had a copy of their master to play with, and we could do anything with it. But sometimes, as I say, we had two non-masters, and the second non-master, which hadn't been used, was still on the shelf. Now, after a while, they would take up lots of space. Now, if we've got an edited master of that programme, there's no point keeping the non-master, because we've already got a cut version, and that's what we want to make the disc from. So the non-masters would be put, I would pull them off the shelf, physically, on a piece of paper, write down the tape numbers, the date, the programme, and then type up a massive list for each different producer, because we had different departments. You would have comedy, you would have classical music, which was called serious music, you would have rock music, you would have talks, you would have drama, all different producers at Kensington House for these programmes, and you'd have to send them the list. And within a week or so, that list would come back, and that producer would have gone through that list and marked the list to say, keep this copy or wipe. So the ones that we were told to keep, we put back on the shelf. The ones that were to be wiped were pulled off the shelf, put in a massive pile, which were as tall as me, and wiped through a degausser, which takes the signal off the tape and blanks them. And then two things that did for us. That meant we could reuse the tape, save money, and also the space on the shelf, we could now move up the tapes and make space for the new stuff that's coming in every day. So you see, after a while, I was looking specifically at music and comedy tapes and getting these lists back from the producers and being told, wipe this, Gary, wipe this, wipe this. And it would be, let's talk music, it would be in concert recordings, it would be that the BBC had done, it would be Radio 1 sessions, John Peel sessions, you know, we'd have copies of those. And they said, wipe all these, Gary, we don't want these. You know, we've got an edited copy of that concert that we want. So after a while, what did I do? If it was a group I liked, I took the tapes home. And the list would say wiped, gone, which they were, but they weren't physically wiped because no one kept a track of the amount of tape that we were generating through the wiping lists. It was just a pile of tape. And the same in the end for comedy. And one of the earliest things I kept was, which I'm now back at the archives, and I do have a copy here, I don't know whether they're out there, was, I'm sorry, I'll read that again, the 1973 series, the after sort of 2.5 year break, they did a series in 73. And we had, I think it was 9 tapes of all, correct me if I'm wrong, 6 episodes. And these were the studio recordings without the edits. So that they were, those programs were running 45 minutes each, if not longer. And obviously when you hear them on the radio, they cut back down, David Hatch will cut them back down to 29 minutes. So there was a ton of bits and pieces, retakes, fluffs, laughing, ad-libs on those tapes. What did I do with them? I took them home and kept them forever. Likewise, I found some earlier, I'm sorry, I'll read that again, in a pile. And they'd been wiped or up for wiping, these tapes, in about 1972. And two of them were still sitting in a pile in 1979. They'd just never been wiped. And I saw one and it just said Iserta on the label, no master label. And I pulled them both out. And it was a studio recording from, I think it was 1968. So it's like, I'm having that. So I just put them in a box and took them home. And obviously, but the thing was, these were on 10-inch reels that ran at 15 IPS, professional speed. I couldn't play them because I certainly couldn't afford a Revox A77 or B77. Remember them? I certainly couldn't afford one of those machines, goodness. But the thing was to keep the recordings. Doesn't matter if you can't play the tapes, at least you've got the recordings. You can play them at some point, which I did. So I got a loads of comedy stuff. Not, unfortunately, transcriptions never issued ever. I'm sorry, I haven't a clue. Ever. They weren't interested. I don't think they thought that the humour would carry abroad. So, which was a shame. But I was diligently recording them off air anyway, always. And I donated, excuse me, I donated all those tapes to Chris Perry at Kaleidoscope when we left the UK. So they're in good hands. I have got copies of them. So, yes, up through the 80s, it was things like Ever Decreasing Circles, which is always good fun because for a start, you've got Richard Bryce. And Peter Egan and the lovely lady who was Richard Bryce's wife, Penelope Wilton. They were all good actors. So they would chat with the audience in between scenes and that kept things really moving along. That was always good. Because for a start, being in the audience, you felt that you were getting something extra that the people at home will never see. So that was lovely. You know, you come out having a little bit of a buzz thinking, oh, I've seen something that no one else will ever see. And then you saw the actual programme, you know, a couple of months later. And you think, ah, this is the one I went to, because you didn't know which episode you were watching being recorded. As I say, sometimes you were given the TX date in advance, sometimes you weren't. They'd just say, oh, keep your eyes on the Radio Times, and that was it. So that was it. So in the end, I left the Beeb in 89, and I went to some commercial video companies, and since I've worked for people like Discovery and Formula One and ITN and MTV, I'm retired now. But I did, in the 2000s, go and see two or three, I'm sorry, I haven't the clues, still with Humph, all with the originals, at places like the Wimbledon Theatre. And I remember that one, for some reason, out the front, waiting to go in, was Tom Robinson. You remember him? The Glad to Be Gay guy and War Baby and all that. And he was out the front. He's a huge I'm sorry, I haven't the clue fan. So, but of course, the drawback for me in those instances was I had to pay for the tickets. It's like, what? I've got to pay? Because obviously every BBC recording I went to, you didn't pay a penny. That was it. I went to a few more Sight and Sounds later recordings. Things like Supertramp at Queen Mary College. The Jam we went to. Sight and Sounds, I can't remember who else. Department S were on. Remember that? Is Vic there? It's another Python connection. Yes, quite a few in concert recordings at the Paris for radio and for the television for Sight and Sound. But yes, so I left the Beeb in 89. As I say, I went to two or three Izzy Hacks in the 2000s. And one of the last things I ever went to, actually, and I found the ticket the other day, was I went to a Hamish and Dougal. And I can't remember which episodes were, but I remember it was recorded at the Mermaid Theatre in London, and I'd only been there once before, and that was with the school. When I was at my secondary school, I went to see Treasure Island at the Mermaid. And two things, that was run by Bernard Miles, the man who did the Mackeson Stout adverts in the 60s, and I think they funded the Mermaid Theatre. And as an aside, years later, during one of my Formula One documentary productions, I actually sat down and interviewed his son, John Miles, who was a Formula One racing driver for a little while in the early 70s. John was a lovely man, and I actually said to him after we'd finished filming that his father, when I went to see Treasure Island at the Mermaid when I was growing up, it was his father that turned me on to the theatre. and going to the theatre, and not just, you know, recordings, but actual plays and National Theatre and all that. And he said, oh, thank you very much. He shook my hand. And but John ran for a while a jazz record label called Miles Music, if you can look that up. John has now sadly passed away a few years ago now. But he was a lovely man, very intelligent. As people say, almost too intelligent to be a racing driver. That's my other passion, motor racing. So when I walked into the Mermaid to see Hamish and Dougal, I suddenly thought, I've been here before. But I've been here before was like 35 years before, if not more. So that was a bit of a deja vu thing. But that was great because obviously, you know, Barry and Graham will act up to the audience at a drop of a hat, you know, dropping a £1 coin, and Barry will perform some one-liners without even thinking, won't he? So that was good. In fact, that was probably the last comedy recording I ever went to. I don't think I'll be going to any more these days, as we're now living in Nairobi, which is a shame. But, you know, I've got some good memories. I've got a friend of mine, Andy Hollingsworth, who you can look up on Facebook, and he has a thing about tickets, recording tickets and live show comedy tickets for both radio and television, not just BBC, ITV, independent productions. Seek him out on Facebook. He has the most amazing collection. I don't know how he finds them. And in fact, some of them he sent me pictures of, and I'm looking at them, I'm thinking, yep, I remember those tickets because they're sort of 1970s radio tickets, comedy stuff. But some of he's got stuff. He's got Python, Monty Python recording tickets for the BBC, that last 1948 show, Broaden Your Mind. Goodness, Frost on Sunday, unbelievable stuff. I think he's even got some Pete and Dud, who are one of my favourites too. I would have liked to have seen them live, but I was too young. But there you go. So anyway, that's my memories of growing up with radio or comedy in the UK in the 60s and 70s, really, and then into the 80s when I was working. So that's it, really. Hope you enjoyed it. Brought back a few memories for you as well as me. So see you soon. All the best.